Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Leithart, and I'm here today with Alistair Roberts and James Bijan. Jeff Myers, who is usually with us for the podcast, is unavailable today. We look forward to having him back in a couple of weeks, and we wish him the best. I've been mildly rebuked for the way I've been talking about Brian Motes for who knows how many episodes. My statement in nearly every episode is that Brian Motes is in the background, and he is recording and he's editing the podcast. But it was pointed out to me that every time I say Brian Motes is in the background, I bring him out into the foreground. And so everyone knows that Brian Motes is here with us. So I welcome Brian Motes to the foreground of the podcast, and am happy for him to join us recording, and he'll be editing and smoothing everything out. He's doing the same thing. It's just that now he's doing it from the foreground rather than the background.
That's right. I'll take over from here, Peter. I'll take over the podcast if you don't mind.
I hope that satisfies the person who challenged me on this on the terminology I was using. We are in the midst of a podcast series in Deuteronomy. We just discovered as we were opening up this recording that we have been doing this for a year. In late March of 2023, that was our first episode in Deuteronomy. We're reaching the latter weeks of March in 2024, and we're still going strong. I think we have a good bit of time left to go before we get through the rest of Deuteronomy. We still have a number of chapters, and we have been going very slowly through the last several chapters as we've been trying to figure out the specifics of Moses' instruction about the Torah and his applications of the 10 words. As I say nearly every podcast, the large section of the middle of Deuteronomy from chapter 5, when the ten commandments are given again, until chapter 25 or 26, we have a series of sermons in which Moses is talking about each one of the 10 words in turn and applying it sometimes in surprising ways and showing how each of these 10 words expands and applies into the corners of Israel's public life. We're currently in Deuteronomy 24, and this is the eighth word section of Deuteronomy. That is, these are applications of the command, thou shalt not steal. We had some discussion, at least I brought the question up some weeks ago, about where the eighth word section ends. Some have argued that it ends with the warning about leprosy and the guarding against leprosy in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 24. My hunch is that the eighth word continues to the end of chapter 24, and hopefully we'll be dealing with that either this episode or next episode and look at those particular laws, many of them having to do with economic relations, loans and credit, gleaning, treatment of the alien and the poor, the widow and the orphan. And I think those are still under the eighth word. And we can perhaps discuss that as we go. But in this introduction, I want to pick out something that this one verse in verse 5, we'll come back to it and talk about it in more detail. But I just wanted to highlight something that I think is intriguing about the way that Moses is dealing with the 10 words and about the character of the law and of the Torah in general. Verse 5 says, when a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army or be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give joy to his wife whom he has taken. So there's a 1 year relief from military service. There's a 1 year relief from apparently any kind of public duty when a man is first married. That echoes with something that we've already covered back in chapter 20, which is in the sixth word section of Deuteronomy, thou shalt not kill. One of the categories of people that is sent home from the army is men who have become engaged and have not yet married. So those who are waiting to marry are let go from public service. Here, those who are newly married are let go from public service and from military service for a full year. It's interesting how, we'll talk a little bit later about how that particular law in Deuteronomy 24:5 is an application of the eighth word. I think there are ways that we can think about that. But it's interesting that the sixth word section, which has to do with war and exemptions from war, and the eighth word section, which in this case has to do with somebody who's newly married, they converge on the same point, which is that a man's marriage and his home and establishing his house and his home and his family takes priority even over military service. A man is to devote at least the first year of his marriage to his wife and building his family. Perhaps the idea is that he will begin having a family, that within the year his wife will have given birth to their first child, and a house will have been established. And it gives priority to domestic life in a way that's, I think, rather unusual in the ancient world. In the ancient world, masculinity is often defined in terms of military service and prowess in battle, in political terms, prowess, and in the agon, the battle, the strife of the public square. And that's how a man gains honor, and that's how a man gains glory. And that's what kind of defines his masculinity. He's fully a man if he knows how to kill people on the battlefield and he knows how to beat his opponents in public debate. And I'm not suggesting that that's absent from Scripture. Surely there's plenty of warriors in the Bible, and there Jesus himself is a master of public debate who defeats his Jewish opponents who try to best him, try to trap him in various debates. There's a long section in the Gospels after Jesus arrives in Jerusalem at the beginning of the final week of his life. There's a series of Jewish leaders, categories of Jews, Sadducees and Pharisees and Herodians. They all come and try to trap Jesus, and Jesus publicly humiliates them by trapping them in turn. So those are certainly part of the mix of what it means to be a man in the Bible. But it's interesting that here in Deuteronomy, we have this focus on the man's priority being to building his house, building his family. And I think that reflects something that is a persistent theme within the Pentateuch, within the Torah. Now you think about the early heroes of Genesis. Abraham, he fights. He is a warrior. He has 318 fighting men that he goes out and fights with. And he's involved in various public battles. But the focus of the story is on his home and the building of his house. And the drama of the story is about his age and the question of whether he will be able to have a son that will inherit the covenant and inherit the promise before he dies. And then Isaac and Jacob are both, again, involved in various kinds of struggles with their neighbors. Jacob struggles with Esau, not hand-to-hand battles or military battles, but he's in a struggle with Esau, and he's in a struggle with Laban. Joseph is in battles and strife with his brothers. So that's part of the mix of masculinity. But with the patriarchs of Genesis, the focus of attention is on domestic life, on building a household, on establishing a family, on having children and raising those children, on wives and marriage. That's an unusual, if not unprecedented, emphasis among ancient texts. You look at the heroes of many ancient myths, and the founding heroes are usually warriors who conquer, not husbandmen and heads of households who are governing their households with justice, as Abraham does, and looking out for their wives and waiting for their children. So the laws in Deuteronomy pick up that same emphasis and points to a pretty significant reorientation of what masculinity means. Masculinity is not just it's not just the public world that's the world of masculinity. Masculinity is expressed in the home. Masculinity expressed in fatherhood, in being a husband, in caring for the flocks and herds, in the case of the patriarchs. All of those are expressions of masculinity, as much as the traditional ancient expressions of masculinity on the battlefield and in the public square.
Peter, just a quick comment about the way in which this rule to do with men going out to fight in their first year occurs in two distinct sections, the way we're looking at Deuteronomy, at least. To my mind, that kind of validates to some extent our approach to this book, insofar as if you think about Deuteronomy as an exposition of the 10, if you like, high-level commandments, it's of course very plausible that the same specific charge here to do with men going out to fight could result from an exposition of different commandments. And the reader can then, of course, be allowed to reflect on how it relates to those different spheres of activity and those different words of the 10 words. And that seems a bit more difficult to figure if somehow you're kind of starting with a list of low-level rules and then just putting them into boxes, kind of grouping them together as you see fit. So there seems to be a kind of a coherence to all this.
Yeah, so the 10 words are broad enough to encompass various zones of life. You think, think of the eighth word that we're dealing with in this chapter, having to do with property and economic transactions and prohibitions on theft and other forms of economic abuse and oppression. But thou shalt not steal is broad enough so that it encompasses these other areas. We're going to start in chapter 24 with the one law concerning divorce that's found in the Torah. Interestingly, it's not found in the seventh word section, but in the eighth word section. I think that's a really important point. The 10 words are broad enough to provide a kind of perspective on other commandments and also on the whole of the 10 words, on the whole Decalogue.
That last remark that you made, Peter, about the situation of the command concerning divorce under the eighth word section is always something that has interested and puzzled me. And I think we find something similar in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus goes through the second table of the law, it seems, and then the summary principle. And the order of the things that are tackled are, first of all, anger, very clearly related to the command, you shall not murder. And that's the sixth commandment. Then you shall not commit adultery and lust. That's clearly the seventh. And then where we'd expect the eighth, it's whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce, which is referencing this chapter. And then you have oaths, not swearing falsely. And then you have retaliation, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, etc., and not resisting. And then finally, the summary principle of loving your enemies. But in both this context in Deuteronomy and in Jesus' treatment of it, divorce is placed under the eighth commandment, which is not exactly where we'd expect it. Maybe it's something that follows on from the context of adultery, the logic of taking another man's wife and then divorce and remarriage being a more formal act of theft, as it were, or something along those lines. I'm not sure. I'd be curious to hear the perspectives that both you and James have upon the situation of this particular material under the eighth commandment, when it seems to me this is not where we'd expect to find it.
No, I mean, I wonder if part of it is to do with the way in which it's actually treating divorce. So we've referred to it as a commandment about divorce, and obviously that is to some extent its subject matter. But at the same time, it's not laying out possible justifications for divorce, which I guess I don't ultimately think that there are any strongly. But rather, it's got a kind of when-then format, if you like. When a man takes a wife and marries her and this happens then. And it's the same with other things in Deuteronomy, isn't it? When you go to war and this happens, and there aren't explicit commandments to go to war and that you're to do this in such and such a circumstance. And rather, I mean, I think the focus of this is almost what should be done given that a divorce has occurred or something. And I wonder if that sheds some light on where it occurs, the fact that it occurs here rather than in the adultery section.
I suppose the further fact is that this isn't a straightforward case of adultery. It could, we imagine, be classed under the principle of not committing adultery as upholding the sanctity of marriage, that sort of thing. But really, this is about what happens in the case of divorce. And there's no statement made one way or another about what led to the divorce, whether there was some infidelity or not. It just says she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, which has clearly been much debated as to its meaning. And so the question is, what happens at that point in a situation where another man now has this man's former wife?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts on the categorization of this law as eighth word. It occurs to me that the language that's used to describe the relation between the man and his wife has overtones of ownership. So when a man takes a wife and marries her, the Hebrew verb is Baal, which is a verb form of the name Baal, Lord. And it can be used to refer to husbands, obviously, as in this case, but also to owners and to lords. And there is a kind of, he takes a wife as a possession. I don't mean that in a demeaning sense that she's just a piece of property, but there is a genuine possession that the man has in the wife. And as Paul points out in 1 Corinthians, it's a mutual possession. Man's body is not his own any more than the woman's body is her own. Verse 2 also uses the terminology of the verb to be, haya, and then she shall be to the man, to the second man, to becomes the wife to a man otherwise. And that form, the verb to be plus the preposition to be to somebody is to be owned by them. So I think that what Alistair suggested initially, I think that there's an eighth word idea in the way that marriage is being conceived of here, that it's not a romantic picture of marriage. It's a marriage, not excluding romance, but it's a marriage of mutual possession. That means that if there's intrusion on that, if a woman is taken from a man, then that would not just be adultery, but there's a kind of theft involved there.
Yes, I mean, that would be reflected to some extent in just the grammar of the thing, wouldn't it? I mean, both in Greek and in Hebrew, the normal way of referring to a husband or a wife is just to use a possessive pronoun of some kind, his woman, or her man, both in Greek and in Hebrew. That's the standard way in which it's done. So that concept of possession seems almost definitional, and in fact, two ways. They each possess the other. So it's not kind of a one-way possessing.
Yeah, right. That's right. The thing, I also want to go back to Alistair's comment about the lack of any kind of justification. Both James and Alistair, you made that point. It doesn't really give us grounds for divorce. It says that the woman finds no favor in her husband's eyes. The phrase that's translated as some indecency in her is a thing of nakedness, which is the very same phrase that was used, I think in the previous chapter, chapter 23, when it's talking about keeping the war camp pure from anything of nakedness, from any indecent thing. It's the very same phrase. That's not specified there either. There are a couple of specific cases of what might defile the war camp back in chapter 23. This is very much unspecified, but the reference to nakedness puts me in mind of several different other texts that might be at work here. Uncovering nakedness is the Levitical way to describe various forms of sexual perversion and sexual infidelity. Incest is the uncovering of nakedness of somebody whose nakedness you ought not uncover. So with the word nakedness, there might be a hint of sexual infidelity there. There's also part of that image is that a man and a woman in marriage are covered by a single robe. The man spreads the wing of his garment over his wife. That's the language of Ruth 3, for example. And so somebody who uncovers that is assaulting not only the woman who is under the cover of her husband, also assaulting the man. But that brings up all of the connotations of clothing and robes and coverings that are coverings for nakedness. And I think back to the connotations of nakedness and in the Noah story, where he's naked in his tent and his sons cover his nakedness. The other thing that when you think in terms of Adam and Eve, they're both naked and not ashamed. They discover that they're naked in the aftermath of their sin. So there's, perhaps some fall reference going on in the background with this phrase. But then also within Genesis 2 and 3, you have this very intriguing and oft-noted pun when you move from the end of chapter 2 to the beginning of chapter 3, where Adam and Eve, the man and the wife, man and his woman, are both naked and not ashamed. And then the very next phrase is that the serpent is the most cunning beast of the field. And that word for cunning is a pun. It has the same consonants as the word for naked. So there, some indecency might have connotations of some craftiness or cunning or deception. So all of those are those inferences. The phrase itself doesn't give us much, but those are some of the ways that the Bible uses that kind of language that might be relevant to the passage.
One thing I guess it might be helpful for us to discuss is why it seems that Jesus particularly applies more stringent, at the very least, applies more stringent criteria on this particular subject, and talks about what Moses permits due to the hardness of heart. And I wonder how we're meant to understand that. I mean, my stab at it would be that we have, on the one hand, a kind of law, a civil law, maybe you could call it, written with the assumption that it's not governing a group of people with regenerate hearts, and that it's trying to exercise damage limitation on sinful men and what they might get up to, rather than, in contrast, New Testament laws that are intended to govern Jesus' church and regenerate men and women. It strikes me as unlikely that Jesus is kind of saying that the state of people's hearts in the first century is just a bit softer than it was in the 15th century, and that therefore he can kind of apply a slightly different law. But yeah, I mean, I'd be keen to know how you read that.
So, but you are making a distinction, if I understood what you're saying, you're making a distinction between the conditions of the old covenant and the conditions of the new. And that would involve a promise of changed hearts. I mean, that's part of the law written on the heart, is part of the promise of the new covenant. You're going to get hearts of flesh. So is that the kind of contrast you were drawing?
Yes, it was. Sorry. I meant that talking about the state of, I meant that Israel as a whole in the first century wasn't more soft-hearted than she. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me that there would be, and this is consistent with the ways that Jesus deals with the law throughout the Sermon on the Mount. He's certainly not easing things up. You know, he's making it more intense. And when he brings up something that in the Old Testament is largely governing conduct, one of the things he does, I don't think that's the only thing he's doing in the Sermon on the Mount, but one of the things he does is emphasize the interior, the demand for interior holiness and righteousness. It's not just adultery that's to be renounced, but the gaze, the lustful gaze, to look at a woman in order to lust for her. The danger is not just of murder, but the various kinds of anger and insult and mutual insult that can lead to violence. And Jesus giving a command to his disciples to arrest that process before it leads to violence. So I think it would be consistent with Jesus' teaching in general that he's saying something more, making it more stringent, higher expectations, sharper expectations, because his people are going to be given the Spirit that will enable them to keep the law.
But it does seem notable that Jesus isn't saying that the law was bad, the law that Moses gave to the people. It was an appropriate law under the circumstances. And law, if it's to be good, needs to be judged by further criteria than merely its resemblance to the ideal that God has for his people. And so Jesus, when he presents that law, he presents it in the light of, first of all, the original order. What Moses teaches is not primarily the permissive, or not even permissive, but this conditional law concerning divorce. His primary teaching is found in Genesis 1-3 concerning marriage, Genesis 1-2 particularly. And so that needs to provide the context for judging the law concerning a fallen situation where people have hard hearts. And a law needs to be effective. It needs to be accommodated to the social reality that's addressing. And we've thought about this at various points. There are laws that simply cannot be enforced in ancient society. And so, for instance, it would be we might say as an ideal, you need to get rid of slavery completely. You need to have a social order that is far closer to perfection than the one that the commandments that we see in Deuteronomy is addressing, but yet that would not be an effective law. A law has to address the people as they actually are, hard-hearted, in a situation that does not have the same developed social functions. It does not have a settled state. It does not have the police functions that we'd expect. And so for that reason, the law needs to speak to that. And a law that didn't, or a law that was not able to be effective or enforced, even if it were portraying a more ideal reality, would be a bad law, because a law needs to be effective. And so it seems to me that this particular case is a very important one for thinking about law more generally, how we think about law as it relates to God's eternal law, the law that we see expressed in the more absolute form in the Ten Commandments and elsewhere, and then law as it's accommodated to a fallen, sinful, hard-hearted, and socially limited society, where you just have to make accommodations to the limitations of the social order, to the sinfulness of people's hearts, etc.
Right, that strikes me as an important qualification. So Jesus isn't saying, as some people have read him to be saying, it would have been better had Moses done such and such a thing. Rather, both what Jesus is saying and what Moses was saying were precisely what God said and were perfect and right for their time. Is that the gist of it, Alistair?
Yes, although the way that Jesus is teaching is very clearly making a distinction between the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 24 as it's addressing this hard-hearted situation, and the teaching of Moses as it's found in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, which is a positive teaching concerning marriage that provides the context within which we understand the permissive accommodation to the sinful, hard-hearted reality. And so he's not suggesting that we dismiss Moses. Actually, he's saying that Moses helps us to understand Moses. Genesis 1 to 2 helps us to understand Deuteronomy 24.
Right.
This passage talks about says that a man who finds no favor in his wife because of this thing of nakedness writes a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her from the house. The second husband is doing this same in verse 3. So there is a record, a written record of the, what I assume are the charges or the reasons for the divorce, why the husband is putting her out of the house. I'm assuming that's what it is. And I'm assuming that it's not prescribed, but that seems to be, that's what's expected, at least by the passage, that a man just can't send his wife out of his house without providing some rationale for his decision and for his cutting her off. But it's a certificate of cutting off. The word for divorce is just a form of karat, which means to cut off. It's the term that's used for both for the formation of a covenant. You cut covenants in the Old Testament, and also for the expulsion from a covenant. You are cut off. Then there's a obvious play on the means of entry into covenant through cutting and the threat of being cut off from the covenant. So he has to provide her with this written certificate of cutting off and before he sends her off. I'm taking that as a protection and a limit or some kind of a barrier to just whimsical, just a man sending his wife out on a whim. And I'm assuming that he has to write something down. If the woman objects and says what he's charging is not true, there's nothing indecent, there's nothing naked in me. And would she have a right to appeal to elders in the gates? I'm assuming that she would. So this, some of the commentators I read talked about this as an indication that marriage and divorce is handled at a family level and the elders don't get involved. And in the scenario that's given here, the elders are not involved, but it seems like things are set up so there could be intervention from some kind of outside authority in case the woman objects to the divorce or if the husband has charged her with something that she's not guilty of. So is that the way you understand the certificate as a kind of rationale for the divorce? And do you all agree with me about the possibility that the woman could appeal beyond her husband if she wanted the marriage, didn't want the marriage to be dissolved?
I do personally, yes. I mean, as a general rule, I guess I think that the harder you make divorce, the less it's going to take place. And I wish it was a lot harder in England. It's become, I mean, compared to kind of 50, 60 years ago, it's become a lot more easy. And as a result, rates are going up and up. And I do see that as a large part of the purpose here. Yeah.
Peter, what are your reasons for seeing this as the actual rationale for the divorce rather than merely a document stating the fact of the divorce?
Yeah, it could just be that. I was making an assumption. I'm tying it to the similar right that we have in Numbers 5, where something is written out, a curse is written out, when a wife is accused of infidelity, and there's this test to determine if she has in fact been unfaithful. Was connecting with that, which is not exactly charges. But that was my question, whether that was a legitimate assumption. I was assuming it had something to do with the reasons for the end of the marriage. So if that may not be, then again, the question is, what does the woman have any recourse? Can she just be put out of the house whenever the man wants to write a certificate? Well, I'm backtracking. I guess I would say he finds no favor because of some thing of nakedness in her. So there has to be something that disqualifies her from being, that justifies his lack of favor for her. That seems to be implied. He has found some thing of nakedness. That's where I'm getting the idea that there's some cause. And then an assumption that that was what's written out.
Right. I mean, part of my thinking was, yeah, the Numbers 5. And also the way in which Jesus segues from talking about the certificate of divorce to talking about the cause. And yeah, it's not explicit, but it often made me think that the cause is apparent from the certificate, and that you could potentially then look at them and see, is this justifiable or not?
In the first century context, of course, this was a matter of debate between various a matter of halakhic debate between the Hillelites and the Shammaites. And so trying to think, the Hillelites argued that divorce, the thing of nakedness, could be any minor infraction. It could be quite a trivial thing. Whereas the Shammaites, divorce could only happen on the basis of some proven serious fault. And that seems to be part of the background for Jesus's questioning and also his response.
Yeah, and I'm taking the thing of nakedness to be some cause that it's not just she finds no favor in his eyes and he writes her certificate of divorce, but she finds no favor because he has discovered something about her or thinks he has, and that's this does seem to be divorced by cause. I think that James made this point earlier that this is not really a law about divorce, although it assumes certain procedures for divorce and maybe assumes that there has to be cause. That's my reading of verse one. But the main thrust of it is what happens in the aftermath. Once divorced, once she's sent away, there seems to be no barrier to her becoming the wife of another man. Verse two, she leaves the house and goes and becomes another man's wife. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with that. The certificate of divorce and the breaking of the first marriage leaves her free to remarry, it appears. And the thrust of it, the then part of the if-then statement or when-then statement, is what happens if the second husband turns against her and he sends her out, or the second husband dies, and then she apparently has the freedom to go and marry yet a third husband. But what she cannot do in verse 4 is to go back to her first husband. That would be an abomination, verse 4 says. It would bring sin on the land to return to her former husband. That's just an odd, of all the scenarios that we'd like to see Moses covering when he's talking about divorce, that's that's one of the oddest that there would be a this seemed very unusual that this kind of thing would occur. In fact, at least one of the points of this, or one of the interbiblical uses of this, at least, is when Yahweh talks about Israel being sent out from his presence because of her infidelities, because he discovers a thing of nakedness in her and he sends her away. And then there's this tangle, there's this legal barrier that prevents Israel from returning. Jeremiah 3 uses this passage pretty explicitly. Beginning of Jeremiah 3, God says, if a husband divorces his wife and she goes from him and belongs to another man, will he still return to her? Will not the land be completely polluted? But you are a harlot with many lovers, yet you turn to me, declares the Lord. Lift up your eyes to the bare heights and see, where have you been violated by the roads? You have sat for them like an Arab in the desert. You have polluted the land with your harlotry and with your wickedness. And then she wants to return, and that's just going to bring even more defilement on the land. Her harlotries have already brought defilement on the land, but her return, her very repentance, brings further sin on the land according to this law. So Jeremiah is applying this divorce law to the relation between Israel and Yahweh, and it creates this legal impasse where Yahweh wants Israel to return. He wants Israel to repent, but if Israel returns and repents, then that just is a further defilement that adds to the defilement she's already caused.
Should we see this law concerning divorce and other such material as something that can be treated as applicable in the same way for men and for women? There is law concerning a woman who would go out from her husband in Exodus chapter 21 in verses 7 to 11, which concerns chiefly the woman who's a concubine, whereas we don't seem to have the presentation of material concerning divorce and even adultery in a way that suggests a sort of interchangeability of the marriage partners. There seem to be conditions and laws concerning divorce that relate to men particularly, and then others that relate to women.
What kind of thing are you envisaging, Alistair? I kind of can't envisage a scenario where a marriage would be lawful for the male party, for instance, but not the female party.
I'm thinking about the, for instance, would we expect the test of jealousy to be applied to a man? Or would we think of, for instance, Exodus chapter 21 is very clearly a gendered situation. There's a man who has a woman sold to him as a concubine, and he needs to provide or sold for this man's son, and he needs to provide her support. It's important that she be dealt with as a daughter, and if she's taken as his wife, then he needs to make sure that she's given her due food, clothing, and marital rights. And that's clearly not something that would apply to a man in the same way. The law concerning divorce here, is this something that would a woman be able to have a certificate of divorce written out for her husband in the same way if she found something indecent in him?
Yeah, there does seem to be some asymmetry there. I mean, judging from the few examples we have, or the few texts we have that deal with the issue at all, there's obviously an asymmetry in the marriage itself. The husband, to use Paul's language, is head of his wife. He's the Baal, he's the Lord, and so women are not, as you're pointing out, Alistair, women are not without rights in a marriage, and if a marriage ends. But it does seem like there would be an asymmetry given the asymmetry of the marriage relation. I wanted to pick up on the kind of allegory that Jeremiah 3 brings up with this passage, where Yahweh is the husband, Israel is the bride. Yahweh sends Israel out. She goes to other husbands, that is to other gods, and then renounces those other gods and wants to return to Yahweh. And Jeremiah is applying this law and saying that that's defilement. And I think that, not sure I can make this persuasive, but I think that that's in the background of what Paul talks about at the beginning of Romans 7. So there's Deuteronomy 24 with this rule about divorce and the prohibition of a woman returning to her first husband after an intervening marriage. Then Jeremiah 3 applies that to Yahweh. And then Paul uses the analogy of marriage to describe how we're freed from the law. So this is from Romans 7. Do you not know, brethren, for I'm speaking to those who know the law, that the law has jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives? For the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living, but if her husband dies, she's released from the law concerning her husband. So then, if while her husband is living, she is joined to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. That's not exactly following the Deuteronomy 24. But if her husband dies, she's freed from the law, so that she's not an adulteress, though she joined to another man. Therefore, my brethren, you were made to die to the law through the body of Christ, that you might be joined to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that he might bear fruit to God. And if you read that passage in the light of Jeremiah 3, you have this situation where a woman is bound by law to a husband. If her husband dies, then she's freed from the law. But then, of course, if the husband dies, she can't return to the previous husband. She can't return to her first husband if that's her desire. And the solution to that seems to be, for Paul, is you are made to die to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be joined to the one who was raised from the dead. So there seems to be the identity of the dead husband with a new husband. Jesus died as the first husband in the flesh, rises in the spirit as the renewed husband. And so that seems to be untangling the dilemma that Jeremiah points out, that there is a way for Israel to return, because Yahweh himself takes flesh and Yahweh, the husband, dies so that Yahweh can also be the second husband she can be a new husband that the bride Israel can return to. I don't know if that I made sense of that reading of Romans 7, but it seems to me Paul's drawing on both of the previous passages in talking about how we can be freed from the law and how a people, a bride that has been estranged from her divine husband, can be restored to her divine husband. It happens because her divine husband has died and risen.
That does make sense. I've wondered about something along those lines, but I haven't been able to put it together as nicely as that. I do wonder, I mean, do you take Jeremiah 3, the first verse, do you take it to be significant who's doing the returning? So initially, if a man divorces his wife, she goes from him, becomes another man's wife, will he return to her? It has, which is, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously, it seems then that the Lord is expecting later on her to return to him, but she doesn't. And do you think that's relevant here in some way?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there is an emphasis there. And clearly that's the scenario that we have in a number of the prophets, where Yahweh is the pursuer of an estranged bride. He's the one who's wants to take Israel back out into the wilderness and renew their nuptial bonds. He's the bereaved, jilted husband who never gives up on loving Israel. So, but it seems to have the same, whether the bride Israel is returning to him or he's returning to the bride, it has the same effect. The land is going to be polluted, completely polluted, if they are rejoined beyond the pollution that Israel has caused by her harlotry. That seems to be the logic of the passage, which I think is rooted back in Deuteronomy.
I wonder if there are ways in which the same thing could be spelt out with the kind of death of an old Israel. I wonder if that could play a similar role.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that might be a better way to read the Romans 7 passage. I mean, Jesus dies and rises again, but at the beginning of that passage, it's we have died, the beginning of that verse, it's we have died to the law through the body of Christ. So both the husband and the bride, as it were, die so the husband and bride can be renewed. And in a sense, it's the first bride reunited with the first husband, and yet they've been transformed by death and resurrection so that there's a possibility for a new start that didn't exist while they were both under the law and in the flesh.
Okay. And then that would follow on nicely from six, wouldn't it? So there would be union in death between Israel and Jesus, and then union in resurrection.
Right. The next verse after this ruling on divorce in verse four verses is the one that I mentioned in the introduction, which is a man taking a new wife. He's free from his military duty. He's free from any public kind of responsibility, building his home for a year. I think one of the things that I think is intriguing here is connected with what we were just talking about with the divorce law applying to Yahweh and his people. The language at the end of verse five, he stays at home 1 year and gives joy to his wife whom he has taken. That terminology has been used earlier in Deuteronomy, primarily of Yahweh providing joy for his people. And the joy is primarily the joy of festivals at his house. Deuteronomy 12 with the central sanctuary that's going to be established. Eat, drink, and rejoice. The Lord is a good husband who gives joy to his people, joy to his bride. And the man is given that as the priority before he's required to go out and fight. His priority is to imitate Yahweh in establishing kind of a domestic Eden that's filled with marital joy and family joy. And another angle on this, it does seem significant that we have the marriage starts with a year of freedom. It feels like a Sabbath year of sorts, that the man doesn't have to take. He's obviously got responsibilities for his house and for his fields, for his flocks, whatever he owns that he makes a living from. But he's not charged with any external duties. And there's a kind of Sabbath year at the beginning of the marriage. It's not a Sabbath year that comes at the end of a period of marriage. But like Adam, the newly married man begins his married life with release.
One thing I've wondered about is we've touched on it already, but the different contexts between this particular law in chapters 20 and 24. It seems connected to fruitlessness in chapter 20. So it is in parallel with the planting of a vineyard, and then the man who goes to war and dies doesn't get to enjoy the fruits of the vineyard. And same with the building of a house, never gets to live in that. And it seems there to do with the reality of war, necessity of war in some cases. It seems a law that's intended to protect the future in some ways. So people who have prepared for the future to enjoy something that they've begun, war isn't to kill that or to end that prematurely. I wonder if here in the context of stealing and so on, I wonder if there's more the idea that there is, I don't know if I'd call it a right, but a legitimate expectation that having been married, that's something that can legitimately be enjoyed, and to force someone to go to war after that's happened is, in a sense, depriving them of their rights or something that they can legitimately expect. I wonder if it's viewed as a type of theft in some sense, as opposed to in chapter 20 when it's viewed as this kind of future terminating thing where it's viewed more in terms of death and fruitlessness and all the rest of it.
Certainly when we think about the curses of the covenant, it's connected with the things that are mentioned under the category of the sixth commandment. The other person who takes the fruit of your vineyard, the other person who sleeps with your wife once you have died, the other person who lives in your house. And in this case, it seems that, as you say, James, the stake of each individual Israelite in the blessing that God has for his people is being defended in part. And so to recognize every single person's stake, and particularly at those times of blessing, when they've just planted a vineyard, when they've just built a house, when they've just taken a wife, it is essential that they be allowed to have the time to enjoy the good gifts that God has given. And to prevent them from that is to steal.
Yeah, that's the kind of direction I was thinking too. You're both kind of saying similar things. And it's either the man is being robbed of his the first year of his marriage. The wife perhaps is being robbed of her expectation or rights to have her husband. Maybe the joy of marriage is being stolen from him. He's being stolen by the army. I think all of those. I think that's how this fits under this heading.
Right. I mean, this is one of the tragedies of war, isn't it? I mean, within the space of a few months or weeks, your entire future can be stolen, if you like, or reshaped. Businesses or families that you've spent years building up and that you've shaped your future around can be gone, you know. And there does seem to be in these exemptions for war in Deuteronomy a recognition of war as a kind of necessary evil. I mean, that's obviously only one side of it. It is at the same time a good, you know, the Lord your God goes out to battle with you. So I don't want to kind of paint it in entirely negative terms, but there seems to be a balance to the law's treatment of war.
We should also think about the way in which laws like this are also protecting weaker people from the demands of stronger people. If you're called to go out to war, it's not just your neighbor who's expecting you to do that. It's the state. It's the demand of the government and the king. And so the protection given here is a protection not just from the demands of brothers and sisters, people who are your peers, but the demands of a much stronger party that you would not be able to resist. And within the sections concerning the 8th and the 9th commandment especially, it seems that a lot of the material touches on issues of oppression, on the ways in which the law, the structures of government, other things like that can be used to suppress and oppress people and prevent them from having their due. And they're not necessarily given their own category in the law, but so much of the material within these two commandments concerns these realities and the way in which stronger parties, official parties, legal structures can be tools of oppression.
Alistair, are you implicitly seeing Theopolis as an oppressive employer who has demanded podcasts from you in your first year of marriage?
Absolutely, yes. I mean,
this is over now.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.